Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Ant, and as always, I'm here with my two friends, Will and Anna.
Hello.
Hi.
This week, we're talking about the year 237 BCE.
Oof.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. And to start us off, if possible, could you please give three-word previews for what we're discussing today? Anna.
My three words are pilfer a goat.
Pilfer a goat. Good. What?
Yep.
A singular goat.
What? Just the one.
Wow.
Yep.
Historical goat.
And you must pilfer it.
Will.
Okay, I'm puzzling that one out. Okay, here are my three. Murderous, but pacifist.
Is that also referring to a goat?
It's the same goat.
That's so good. Mine is nearly scuppered, mother.
Ooh.
Oh, punctuation in the three words.
That's maybe our first one that's like a sentence.
I wanted to fit in one more word, but I'm not going to do that because there are rules and we have to keep by them.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's absolutely not allowed.
You can't. Three words only. I mean, infinite punctuation.
Yeah, I've been yelled at for my three words in the past.
But we should try. I think we should give awards to one another for the most meaning that you can pack into the three words. Like is it Hemingway who came up with those six-word stories?
Yeah, for sale, baby shoes never worn.
Right.
Yeah.
That would break the rules, three words.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Hemingway would be right out.
It could be two episodes. For sale, baby. Shoes never worn.
But a lot of people have always said about me that I'm twice as efficient as Hemingway in my writing.
Should we go on and have an efficient podcast?
Oh, I don't think that's in the cards.
Yeah, this week was genuinely very challenging. It was a very long time ago.
Yeah.
There was nothing really happened in 237 BCE that I wanted to talk about.
Look forward to the episode, listeners.
Yeah, you're in for a treat.
Here we go.
Okay, so I'm starting us off, and this week I am talking about the Egyptian pharaoh, Ptolemy III. Now, before we get started, Ptolemy is spelt with a silent P at the start of the name,
mm-hmm.
So if you want to Google and do some research afterwards, it's P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, and then three spelt just three.
I-I-I.
P-I-P-I-P-I. So Ptolemy III was the son of Ptolemy II and the grandson of...
Okay, do you want a joke guess? Or I think I know the answer.
Wrong, Ptolemy I. he just went by Ptolemy, though, during his lifetime. While you think...
Not like Timmy or something.
Timmy, yeah.
Or Trey.
Trip. Or PT.
Is it presumptuous for me to call myself William the First?
No, I think you're fine. I think as long as there's two more, and we will be checking, because this is going to go on for 3,000 episodes, remember?
Yeah, 60 years.
So you might think that his ascension to the throne was guaranteed because, you know, he had the name. It turned out to be not so straightforward. He was taken out of the royal succession due to what is said to be his mother's indiscretion and disgrace. There's no details on this, but I'm hoping it was something badass at the very least and not just something benign and just anti-woman, as it probably was.
But that was his mother's fault.
His mother did something disgraceful, brought the name into disrepute, and as a result... Ptolemy the Third was taken out of succession order.
Well, you should always punish the children for the mother's mistakes.
The sins of the mother.
Yeah,
exactly. But so this is where nearly scuppered, mother comes in. This is getting in there early with my three words because I didn't want to give anything away.
And you succeeded.
You're welcome. But Ptolemy does.
Wait, hang on. Stop. So hang on. Okay. Shouldn't it be mother nearly scuppered? Rather than...
In hindsight, I didn't put a lot of effort into the three words. I just had the ghost of Hemingway on my back, saying, this is never going to be good enough. You'll never get into the...
You could have said, and we can move on after this, but you could have... You could have squeezed another word in there had you hyphenated and said, nearly mother scuppered something else.
Or son, nearly mother scuppered.
Yes,
and it would be a semicolon.
There it is.
For your turns. Okay, and I'm going to completely tear you a new one.
Sorry, keep going.
Back to the thing we're all here for, education. So Ptolemy manages to get back into his pop's good books, and he does ascend to the throne when he's 34. So he's quite aged at this stage, 34. And the dynasty, the Ptolemic dynasty at this time is at its peak. It really is a powerhouse. And he furthered the gathering of wealth and power, centralizing it into Egypt by marrying, I think it's Berenice, or maybe Bernice spelt in a funny way, Bernice II, who was the queen of Sinica and was his half-cousin in modern-day Syria. So he took those lands and brought them centralized. But Bernice is actually pretty interesting too. I want to focus on her for a little bit. She ruled shortly after the death of Alexander the Great, and her father, Magus, was fighting with Ptolemy II, and Berenice II was just kind of cool.
So her dad was like at war with his dad? And then they did the old marry the enemy's daughter union thing.
Yeah, I'm not going to mention the TV show that I have in mind where there's several thrones, they're playing a game about them, but I think we sort of have to ban that.
It
is very much of that ilk.
Well, were they like Romeo and Juliet in that they were in love with each other despite warring families? Was a marriage of...
Oh, this is a marriage of convenience, land acquisition.
Yeah.
But Berenice on her own was pretty cool. Apparently there's a quote from the astronomer Gaius Julius Hyganus, and he claims that when Berenice's father Magus and his troops were routed in battle, Berenice mounted a horse, rallied the remaining forces, killed many of the enemy, and drove the rest to retreat. It does go on to say the veracity of the story is unclear, but quote, it's not on the face of it impossible.
I feel like once an episode we have a disclaimer like that. Like, it almost certainly didn't not happen.
I love historians passively aggressive taking chunks out of each other is my favorite thing that I've learned. She did come to power in spite of her own mother plotting against her and trying to undo the promise of Magus to marry Berenice to Ptolemy the Third, and instead wanted to marry her off to a guy called Demetrius the Fair. Demetrius, with the help of the former queen consort, her mother, Apme, took control of the city of Cyrene and, basically was going to sort of force this marriage to Berenice to sort of keep the power away from...
So she wanted her to choose a nice local boy.
Yeah, exactly. Nice local boy.
Yeah, okay.
So this came undone, though, when Berenice found this handsome chap, Demetrius, in bed with her own mother.
Oh!
And so did the only reasonable thing and had him assassinated.
I mean, there is a lot of mother scuppering in this tale.
There really is.
So hang on, can we just unpack that for a moment? Mm-hmm. So her mother was trying to set her up with this apparently nice person.
Handsome Demetrius.
And simultaneously she was sleeping with him.
She was scuppering.
Yeah, why do we think she wanted to keep him close, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
I really admire her mother. That's very...
some strong independent women here. But after the assassination, there wasn't so much to be married. And that kind of put an end to Atme, her mother's conniving. And so Bernice took the throne.
In Egypt.
In Syria.
Oh, sorry.
Before marrying Ptolemy and uniting it. Anyway, so she marries Ptolemy III and unites the once fighting lands. And they did this really cool thing, which I'm really supportive of, is they formed a cult to worship themselves.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, so her and her husband were gods, which is great. So much better than just regular old king. Ptolemy was known also as Ptolemy the Benefactor. Huh. He massively encouraged trade. And he actually built a library at Alexandria.
He's the one who did the thing.
No, not the great library of Alexandria, but like a secondary sort of backup.
Oh, right.
Just a library. A library. Not the library. Yeah.
So he brought he built the famous Ptolemaic library overflow unit.
Pretty much.
Book depository.
Book depository annex.
And he actually tied this with the trade. It's really interesting. So he encouraged this free trade and moving about. However, any books coming into port had to be confiscated and copied in this backup library and then given back to the sailors or whatever. So he was centralizing knowledge and science and amassing this wealth as well. And as a result, some discoveries sort of came about from this. So his librarian of the backup library, like the lesser known one, made discoveries with the help of these texts, calculating the distance between the earth and the sun.
Oh.
Also understood and calculated that the earth was round and that the earth spun on an axis. So all of this in 327 BCE is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
You know?
We maybe giving too much credit to the librarians here? how much credit in principle belongs to the person discovering the thing versus the people who assembled the information and made it available?
Well, so this librarian allegedly made this discovery. However, he could have just copied it from a book that he got on a ship and then put his name at the bottom of it.
Because Ptolemy, we're in the time in Egypt when it's ruled by the Greeks, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
We're probably taking some knowledge from Greece. Yeah, okay. But still, we love librarians.
He also... Sure. A controversial statement.
I'm just putting it out there.
Those peddlers of knowledge and paper cuts. He also built the Temple of Horus at Edfu, which is one of the masterpieces of this era, and it's still standing. It's one of the best preserved of all Egyptian temples. And he also formed an alliance, as well as becoming a god himself, formed an alliance with the elite priests, which were the top priests at the time. And he built numerous still standing structures to Amun and other gods. He furnished them with power and wealth, and they unanimously agreed that he was a very good pharaoh and so blessed his time as in charge. However, he did nearly come a cropper when he got stuck into a third Syrian war, where he did successfully march his troops all the way there, and every town sort of, you know, gave up and surrendered willingly to him. But when he got there, he had to turn back because there was a bit of a revolt back at home because the crops had failed. Yeah, so he had to come back and sort that out. But when he did come back, he started issuing some decrees and he realized there was some structures in society that wasn't really working. And he carved on hieroglyphics and, he carved on stones for the first time, not just hieroglyphics, but also in ancient Greek. And also in another language called Demotic.
Demotic. Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, you're getting excited.
I'm so excited.
I feel like I'm straying into your knowledge base.
You have strayed well into the base.
God. But anyway, on these stones, these trilingual stones, he talked about how the priesthood should have some reforms in them, what should happen in times of war and famine. Basically, sort of semblance of slight social welfare-esque. And he also added an extra day in the year every 4 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ptolemy leap year.
Ptolemy day.
Which is what it will be called henceforth.
Yeah. And so to kind of wrap this up, this practice of inscribing decrees like on the stone that's not just hieroglyphics continued after him. And his son, guess his name.
Go on, Anna.
Mother Scupper,
Ptolemy IV, was responsible for inscribing the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah,
which allows us to understand hieroglyphics. And Ptolemy III lived until he was 58, which at the ancient at that time.
Yeah.
Because people were dying, you know, people getting past 40 was a rarity. So he was like this ancient, ancient being. And then he passes on. And
why was it so, why were people not living very long at that? I mean, I know, obviously, like, modern medicine and all that.
But, is this a serious question?
Yeah.
No, because my understanding was that historically, the thing that suppressed life expectancy was like child mortality. And actually, once you get past, you know, into adulthood, actually people lived quite long.
Diet, medicine, running with scissors, like, all these things.
Failed wars in Syria.
Also, I'd like to make a second point, please, if you'll indulge me, which is around like how much of the things that you mentioned were things that those people actually did as themselves, as the king at that time, or pharaoh, versus were just things that were going on amongst the learned people of that society during their reign. And so they're kind of like,
they take credit for it.
It would have happened anyway. Yeah. You know, like,
I love how you're asking these questions like we have some sort of specialized knowledge of 237 BC.
Well, when
forgot,
I was there.
I forgot which podcast I was on.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Come on, Will.
Okay, I withdraw my question and I will Google it.
I mean, you are right, to be boring for a second. History is written by the pharaohs that survive, right? So, you know, maybe he didn't do any of this. Maybe he was just this very lazy dude and people were just cleaning up around him. But
yeah.
I don't want to believe that. I think Ptolemy's 1-4 were great.
Yeah, and I look forward to celebrating Ptolemy Day every February 29th.
Every February 29th.
Every 4 years.
Well, that's my portion. Who's next?
Nice. Okay. Very cool.
Awesome.
William.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm going to talk about the story of the Emperor Ashoka, who ruled in modern-day India from 268 BCE to 232 BCE, when he died in his early 70s. So the year we're interested in, he's already about 65-ish and has ruled for 30-odd years.
So he was 65.
Another old guy.
Ancient.
Yeah.
Ancient for the ancients.
And he's a fascinating figure for a couple of reasons. So first, because he ruled such a large swathe of what is now modern India, and he influenced its culture quite dramatically and its development for centuries to come. So he was just a generally influential dude. And then the second major reason is because in his latter years, after conquering a whole bunch of territory and experiencing the horrors of war and everything that was associated with that, he became a pacifist. And turned to Buddhism. His overall influence was sort of twofold. It was both expansionist, but then it was also kind of defined but latterly by this period of stability, brought about by his stopping expanding. and there was a bit of a snag, though, arguably, with his interpretation of pacifism. So can you guess what the snag was?
Violence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it. You nailed it. So he wasn't so much a pacifist as just someone who didn't want to expand their territory anymore. And when it came to internal revolts or people attacking his territory, he was still very content to be extremely vicious and violent.
Okay.
So he's less a pacifist than just a
defensive.
Yeah, or just a never expander.
A never expander.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That school of thought.
Yeah. So anyway, his story really starts like about 60 years before he was born, really, or 100 years before the year we're interested in 326 BCE, because that was the year that Alexander the Great first crossed the Hindu Kush Mountains. And Alexander came in with his big veteran army, who had been through a lot by that point, and they settled down in the Indus River, and he summoned to him the two local kings of this part of India to him to sort of pay homage and to submit to his reign. Mm-hmm. And it turned out in the end, one of them did, and one of them ended up not doing that and trying to fight him in battle, and ended up then losing that subsequent battle. And there were a bunch of other small skirmishes and minor battles that happened, like that Alexander and his gang got up to at that point. And then, somewhat famously, Alexander's army then mutinied at this point very shortly afterwards. This is the furthest east they ever got, and wanted to go back to India. And one of the reasons they'd mutinied was that they'd heard of a powerful empire to the east in India that they're about to encounter, called the Nanda Empire, which dominated this northeastern part of India at the time. Oh. So that's why Alexander's one of the reasons, in addition to just generally being, you know,
expansionist.
One of the reasons they mutinied.
Exhausted. Just absolutely exhausted.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, Alex is great, but I mean, the army is wrecked.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
At that stage, they've gone very far east. They've conquered everything. Massive.
Yeah.
Logistics. Posts must take ages to get to them. How many years are on the road for? Blisters?
They're not getting care packages.
No care packages.
So there's a whole bunch of reasons. And it isn't just the Nanda Empire, but the Nanda Empire was like something they're about to have to go and tackle next. And they thought, no, that's too much for us. So anyway, Alexander's army turned around and they scarped back to Macedonia. But in their wake, they had hugely influenced the military culture of that area because of all the way they conducted themselves, the kind of battles they'd fought, the way they'd handled their politics and logistics and playing people off against each other and all that sort of thing. And all of those lessons then became really important for later warlords in that next 100 years and influenced the way that they went about.
Now, how were they leaving these? Were they like scribbling down notes and then just sort of throwing them behind them? Or was it people were observing it?
It was an internship, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like vocational college.
Like?
Yeah. No, well, they famously subscribed to Kanban. So they had they had lots of post-its, lots of post-its everywhere. Yeah. They got a burn down board.
Sprints.
But those post-its were then left everywhere all over Northwest India.
His full title is Alexander the Great. Project manager.
Yeah. Sorry, hey, product visionary.
Product visionary.
and so lots of people who came next learnt from the lessons that they had picked up from their
army. Post-its. Yeah.
From the post-its. This is very much, by the way, I think the role our podcast plays for the modern listener is really a school in expansionist conquest.
We are very famously expansionist.
Yeah.
And so this is where Ashoka's grandfather comes in. So the point really I'm trying to make about Ashoka and all this history that comes before him is that Ashoka actually arrived with a lot of things going for him. So Ashoka's grandfather was really the one who came out of semi-obscurity, picked up on all the lessons from Alexander, knocked out the Nanda Empire, and established quite a large empire first place.
Okay.
So really, Ashoka's grandfather, cool dude, future episode maybe.
So it's a real from riches to riches kind of story. Isn't yeah. You know, you're just born into kinghood. And
it's
then
a Trumpian, like, yeah. From riches to ever so slightly more riches. Yeah. And then Ashoka himself was now 60 years later after this time. And Ashoka himself was like the least favored son in his dynasty. But that was partly because of the two women that his father married. His Ashoka's mother was the least high status, was the lowest status per woman. And so as a result, Ashoka really struggled. And then when his father died, he had to fight his brothers or his half-brothers to gain control of the kingdom. So there's about a four-year civil war. And Ashoka at this point, one of the reasons he managed to get the success he got was because he was so aggressive and vicious, but also quite cunning in terms of the politicking, and he brought the father's ministers with him and that kind of thing. But basically, he fought this four-year civil war, and
now,
that's how he got the power.
What TV show would you say this is most like?
Rugrats?
Yes, I was thinking the same thing.
Or The Office.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Because of the post-its.
Sorry, go on.
And I'm not going to say it.
For the listeners at home, there's a fine for whoever says this TV show first.
And once they'd finished their playing around over these seats of authority, he then embarked on a massive campaign to expand the territory that he'd already been given, which, as we discussed, is already quite a lot of territory. And so he embarked on a bunch of different battles, And at the last one, the final one really, was an enormous scale, took forever to break into a city, which was under siege, and these people wouldn't give up. And in the end, hundreds of thousands of people were killed, either as a direct result of the violence in this area in northeast India, or as a result of the disease and pestilence that took place during the siege situation. Mm. So absolute devastation. And one of these, I think, as an aside, you know, I think in the West, we're just totally unfamiliar with like the vast scale of these things happening in Eastern India at the time. And it was in that context that he had this realization that maybe war was a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
And then he became much more pacifistic after that. Although one could, to be cynical for a moment, accuse him of really only becoming a pacifist now that there was basically nowhere else left to conquer. And so, as mentioned earlier, he then ruled what he'd already conquered with an iron fist anyway.
Yeah.
And then, so during this latter stage of his career, once he had settled on the territory he'd actually then seized, he then very conveniently became a pacifist and turned to Buddhism. And that period there was then characterized, to be fair on him, by a very long period of stability and, relatively speaking, like calm politically, which meant he could expand the cultural influence of that empire across India.
Okay.
And so they ended up bringing Buddhism to places it wasn't before. It ended up pushing Buddhism a bit further east, and then also down to places like Sri Lanka, which is where it took hold in Sri Lanka, was during that period because of his influence. And that was Ashoka. Pretty influential.
Not to be totally binary about it, but I'm confused.
Yeah.
Good guy or bad guy?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, I need to simplify.
Yeah, let's have a final
judgment.
Yeah, simplify.
Really need to simplify this down.
I'm going to say much like a modern day tech magnate, he chose to accumulate power and then use it for good.
Now, when you say magnate, do you mean
magnate? No.
Pronounced magnet.
Is it pronounced magnet?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. No, sorry, to be clear, I'm talking about the electromagnetic.
A tech magnet.
I'm talking about tech magnet, like in my speaker, in my laptop.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha, good.
So what do we say? So good then, bad then good? Or bad so he could be good? Or
oh, yeah, good to be bad?
Good to be bad? There's a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, a nuanced character, neutral, trending, positive.
I think net neutral.
Trending. Net neutral.
Net neutral. Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
There you are.
Nice, Ashoka. I today am in China. Well, I'm not. I'm in the podcast studio, but metaphorically. And this is the first time we've talked about China on the podcast, which I think is interesting, right?
Yeah, because, well, famously, no history has happened in China.
Right, very short history.
Very, very sporadic bursts of history.
I was kind of like saving them up for when we got a BCE year. And so today, here we go. So as a background, at this time in China, it is not united. It is, in fact, split into seven kingdoms.
She's going to say it. She's going to say it.
It's not. Is it really?
It really is. I'm not kidding. I will not say the name of the show, George. but yes, the seven kingdoms, and it's a time called the Warring States period. I helpfully found this description. The Warring States period was an era in ancient Chinese history characterized by warfare.
Why are you pronouncing the full stop in that way?
Oh. Okay. That took me a long time. Americans, you don't get that joke.
I'm cutting this one out.
Yeah. So the Warring period starts in around 475 BCE, and we're still going a couple hundred years later. Today's protagonist is a man named Ying Zheng. And he is the son of the king of Qin. And Qins were one of the states in the Warring States period. And around the time in question, 238 BC maybe, he becomes king of Qin. And then he sets about uniting all of the Warring States to have a unified China for, I think, maybe the first time, or at least the first time in a long time. His plan focused on allying with distant states and attacking nearby ones, which was one of the 36 stratagems.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So just a quick sidebar on the 36 stratagems. This is an essay about warfare that probably originated in written and oral history, and then different versions were compiled by different authors throughout Chinese history. And all of the stratagems are these wonderfully simple but really layered, complex metaphors. Yeah. And I'd like to mention a few of them because the names are really incredible, including hide a knife behind a smile, which is, I think, what Will does every day.
That is so true.
Borrow a corpse to resurrect the soul.
That is less clear to me.
Yeah. Remove the firewood from under the pot.
What? I'd say that's a thing you must do with pots rather than a stratagem for warfare.
In order to capture, one must let loose.
Yeah, like party hard.
Party hard. Work hard, play hard.
Work hard, play hard.
And then finally, take the opportunity to pilfer a goat.
No.
Yeah. And that one being, you know, as you're warring, if you have the opportunity to materially hurt your enemy as well as sort of enact violence on them, you should take that opportunity. You should take their stores, you should take their animals, pilfer their goats.
Okay.
So a little sidebar in the 36 stratagems there. Anyway, back to Ying Zheng's Wars of Unification. There is just an impossible number of wars and surrenders and natural disasters and battles. I mean, Will, you would even get tired of it. Suffice it to say that Ying Zheng and the Qin unified all seven warring states in just 9 years. Very impressive. Wow. I will share one particularly brutal story, is that the crown prince of the state of Yan attempted to assassinate Ying Zheng, even though the prince's father was trying to negotiate an alliance with him. The attempt fails. Ying Zheng is pissed and decides that instead of an alliance, he'll make war against the Yan. This does not go very well for the Yan. And ultimately, the king of Yan orders his son's execution and sends his head to Qin as an apology for the assassination attempt.
Oh, wow. So he kills his own
son. He killed his own son because his son tried to assassinate this guy.
Did that successfully take the log from underneath the kettle?
The pot? Yeah, yeah. I think for sure it was in order to capture one must let loose.
Yeah, that is loose as it gets, really.
It's loosey-goosey. But it worked. Qin accepted the apology, if we can call it that, and he doesn't attack Yan for the next 3 years, which is nice. 3 years.
That is the most profuse level of apology available, isn't it?
Pretty big.
And one son's head is worth 3 years of peace. So it doesn't scale very well.
Not very well. But he took over the place in 7 years. I mean,
9 years.
Massive area of land. Kingdoms.
And actually want to come on to that because we're talking about huge numbers of people here.
Yeah.
So a few episodes ago, we were marveling at the Safavids bringing 40,000 troops to Kandahar and all their tactical rabbits. but it was reported that the Qin had 1 million infantry.
No, don't buy it.
1,000 chariots and 10,000 horses.
How do they all fit in all those chariots and horses?
No way.
I mean, so it is probable that the numbers were...
100,000 people per chariot.
I mean, so it's probable that the numbers were exaggerated, but I still think we're talking about just enormous armies.
I mean, even
hang on, it's 100 people per chariot, which is still impressive.
Sorry, did I get my maths wrong?
But it's still, I mean, how many layers up are you there? You probably have to, well, I suppose you could get 10 crammed in and then another 9 layers on their shoulders.
That's a big human pyramid.
Yeah, you've got to have a lot of core strength to hold that many people on top.
Yeah, it's like one of those chariot display teams you see at fairs.
What fairs do you go to that has chariot display teams?
You know, one of those fairs.
I've been to a fair and they had like a motorbike display
team. I'm convinced you're a time traveler from ancient Greek. I'm absolutely convinced of this. Oh yeah, the chariots. But even if they were exaggerating the numbers.
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't exaggerate that much. Even as an order of magnitude, that's
still
100,000 people.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like, oh, there were 500 guys and they wrote down it's a million. Like, it was huge. So once Ying Zheng has unified the kingdoms, he takes a new name. And I listened to a pronunciation of this about 50 times, and I'm still going to botch it. But his new name is Qin Shi Huang, which means first emperor of Qin.
Is there a question mark at the end of his name?
Nope, that's just me saying, was that right? So once he's emperor, he does some bad things like banning and burning books and executing scholars, none of which I am in favor of.
It depends on the scholar, really, in the book.
Well, and here's the thing. it's possible, it's theorized that he was burning books because he wanted to focus his scholars' minds on the quest for immortality.
Okay.
He's obsessed with alchemy, finding the elixir of life. And some historians speculate that he executed his scholars as a test of their abilities, because if they had discovered the magic, they'd just come back to life.
Did he discover it in the end?
Or
is that a spoiler?
That's a spoiler.
Okay, okay. I'll wait till you get there.
Can I just, were you just attempting to somewhat qualify or even defend the execution of scholars?
No. Historians are, and it has become patently obvious.
How many scholars do you think it's worth killing to discover the elixir of life?
I don't know how many you'd have to do. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine how the conversation would go, and I suppose it's something along the lines of, so you got an elixir of life, have you? And they're like, yeah. And like, okay, how sure are you? Are you me kill you right now sure?
No. Well, then you're a bad scholar, killing you anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, better than being the ninth guy on the chariot stack.
Oh, God. Imagine being the base layer of the chariot stack.
So just to round it out a little bit, he did some, I think, objectively positive things. He built a massive new national road system, infrastructure we love. And he commissioned the Terracotta Army. The World Heritage Site, 8,000 terracotta soldiers and hundreds of chariots and horses. And so he died in 210 BCE. And if we get that year or close to it, I'm going to do a whole episode.
But what was the purpose of that terracotta army?
To like guard his tomb.
And it's so fascinating because when they first discovered it, the terracotta soldiers were not terracotta. They were beautifully painted.
Yeah.
And they oxidized extremely quickly and faded into the sort of terracotta brown. So they stopped the excavation of them. So there's still, you know, innumerable number of terracotta soldiers still buried.
Why did they stop the excavation?
Because as soon as you expose it to air, they didn't have the technique, the cost, whatever it
was. So they're waiting for some future decade when they can
potentially. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Fascinating.
When the tech magnet comes and sucks all the air out.
Yeah.
Magnetically. Terracotta Army, super, super cool. Check our Insta. I'll put something up about it. And the last cool thing that Qin Shi Huang did is he unified the Great Wall of China, sort of.
Yeah.
So walls had been built as early as the 7th century BCE, including around the kingdoms that he had just conquered. So he ordered that those walls be demolished. And then he built new walls to fortify the northern frontier. And then successive dynasties built up around it until it became the Great Wall as it exists today. And one more note about the size of the empire. It's estimated by some authors that hundreds of thousands, if not up to a million workers, died building his wall.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Great Wall of China is, you know, it's a massive, massive, massive thing.
Yeah.
And it's not just one perimeter. It's like all spiderwebby and
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly.
It goes everywhere.
So I don't think any of his wall exists, but certainly what was built up on top of his wall exists. So one just final postscript to answer your question, Ant, about if he did discover the elixir of life.
Is he here today? Is he a special guest?
I'd like to introduce friend of the pod, Qin Shi Huang. He does die in 210 BCE, possibly from ingesting the mercury that his alchemist said would give him immortality.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, quicksilver.
Not because he just forgot to drink the elixir that day.
We'll never know, you know. He could have just forgotten to drink it.
Please do not drink mercury at
home. Just gonna go ahead demand that.
Don't tell people how to live their lives.
Okay. You're right, we're a very libertarian podcast.
Look, so you know what, everyone, if you want to go and drink mercury, you go and drink some mercury.
People should be free to open carry mercury wherever they want.
please don't do that.
So one final story. I know I've said one final bit like 8 times, but this guy is so interesting. After he died, he was like out on the road, and his prime minister was really concerned that if people heard the emperor had died, the unified kingdom would fall apart. So they legitimately, like Weekend at Bernie's, this guy for the 2-month journey back to the capital.
Oh, wow.
They put him in his carriage. They pulled down the shades. They changed his clothes daily. And then in a stroke of genius / insanity, they ordered two carts of rotting fish to be driven before and after his carriage to disguise the smell of rotting corpse.
Wow.
I don't know if that's one of the 36 stratagems. Well, and I guess in case someone saw him.
If they had the blinds down.
Yeah, you know, redundancy.
Yeah,
right?
Okay, fine.
Or maybe just out of a sense of honor. Anyway, when they got back to the capital 2 months later, they announced his death after having time to prepare. But I thought that was just an absolutely
wild
story.
That's interesting they didn't,
story.
Like, embalm him. And
yeah.
Because in Egypt at the time, they were already doing that, right?
Yeah. Ptolemy would have sorted him out. No problem.
Ptolemy would have sorted. It's possible that they were just, I mean, if they're 2 months' journey away from the capital, it's possible that they were just somewhere really remote that didn't have the
embalming kit with them.
I thought he'd been pretty well pickled with mercury in his blood as well.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought that was a totally wild story, and he's a really interesting guy. And then, you know, we'll learn more about China later, I'm sure. Because
no, that's the only thing that ever happened.
That's the only thing that ever happened until the Beijing Olympics, which is outside
2008,
outside of the range.
We can't do it. So we can't do
that's it.
Well, I really enjoyed that. Full stop.
Yeah.
237 was a tough one. It was really tough.
But I'm really proud of what we did.
We're over the threshold level of believability there for all of it, which is not technically impossible. For each of the claims made.
Very proud of us.
Yeah, not too shabby, guys.
There you are, 237 BCE.
So, good news. We have succumbed to peer pressure and we have a Patreon now.
Ooh.
Where we've had people signing up for one of our 3 tiers of membership. And we thought we should do a bit of a shout out to our first ever board member who signed up a while ago.
That's right. And worth knowing that the 3 tiers get you slightly different things. So you can be a friend of the club, which gives you basically a warm and fuzzy feeling for supporting us. And in one day in the future, if we ever ran ads, you would get to not have to listen to those ads, which is great. And then the next tier is being a club member, which means you get an even greater level of smugness. You'll also get early invites to our live events and an invitation to our quarterly quiz that we will be doing online. And then the top tier is...
Board members. These are the kind of people that cruise through life in plush leather-clad exteriors.
Yes.
They have a glass of brandy or cognac at all times. Mm-hmm. You know, just the gentle clink of diamonds as they walk by.
They have servants who could summon up a cart of dead fish to disguise.
Yes. When they die.
Before and after them, wherever they go. And if you're not one of these people already, you will become one of those people as soon as you join the club
guaranteed.
Board. So you have that to look forward to. And we'd like to give a shout out to one of those members today. So Vivek, thanks so much for joining and becoming a member of the club board. We appreciate your support.
He was actually our first official ever board member.
Yeah, absolute hero.
Absolute hero.
And I would also like to shout out a friend of the pod, a great friend of the pod, Chinwe. She's been all over the socials, tweeting, liking, Instagram. So you can find her in the like section of our Instagram.
She is my only non-EU Twitter follower at the moment, I would have to say. So thank you very much.
Did you say non-EU?
Non-EU as in the two
as
of
in
you.
The sheep.
No, the two of you. Yeah, the sheep. But you don't have to sign up for any of our patrons, etc. Just by listening, we consider you an acquaintance of the show.
A colleague.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't go that far. I think non-paying customer.
A thief.
A moocher. Thief.
We consider you all thieves.
And the only way you can repay us is to tell your friends and keep subscribed and listening. It does mean a lot to us. We get a kick out of us. And it means we'll just keep on going, making more.
And in fact, to do more, we need our next year. So can we boot up the random number generator?
We can. I will fuel it up with rotten fish.
It really takes anything. It's like the DeLorean.
And okay, it's up to full speed. And the year for next week is 1531.
1531. Okay. Back to comparatively modern times.
That's quite exciting.
Yeah.
What are we thinking? I have no idea. Hang on.
Shakespeare?
What happened?
Shakespeare. Definitely Shakespeare, yeah.
I mean, genuinely close.
When was he? 16-something.
He was a bit later.
Yeah, I think he was
a bit later.
No, 1531. I think England was found.
Shakespeare's conception.
I actually... I might have an idea.
Oh.
Just the one.
Brilliant.
And so cliffhanger on that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool.
You have to tune in and see if I did have an idea.
On that cliffhanger.
See you next week for Anna's idea.
Toodles.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.